Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Armchair Producers, Episode 4. I am your host, George Tarrant, along with the ever-present Mr. Travis Croft. How are you this Sunday evening?
Yeah, a little crock, so our regular listeners might...
A little crock.
A little nasal, so I apologise for that in advance, but we are soldiering on.
Yes, we will deliver adequacy.
An hour of nonsense, I think that's what Kirk Cameron would want of us.
Well, yeah.
I mean, he's struggling on for...
He's still fighting. He's fighting the good fight of God.
Against Hurricane, too.
Yes. It's not nature. It's God being angry with you.
Yeah, you're only listening this week, Kirk. We need to interview.
Yep. I mean, you can always just reach out to us.
Reach out, that's what we're
at. At the Fried Brain, at Evil Trav, we'll be there for you, man.
This is a forum for you.
Yes.
It's a safe space.
Yes. There are no bad ideas at Armchair Producers.
And I think the fact that we're still going is proof of that.
Exactly.
72 episodes, I think. Now.
Rolling in the GNT stuff, yes.
Of, the Armchair Producers.
Yeah.
Welcome if you're a new listener.
Yes, welcome.
If you are enjoying... listening to this crap.
we hold ourselves in high esteem.
The sparkling repartee. There are a good 60-odd episodes you'll find in the back catalogue.
Actually, at the moment, no, because iTunes. That's the answer. I'm working on it, though.
Apple for you.
I'm working on it.
They're famous lost episodes.
Yes.
I just finished reading a book called Tinseltown.
Okay.
About a famous murder of an early silent film director in Hollywood called William Desmond Taylor.
Right.
Which was the murder of a century in 1921, or whatever it was when he was murdered.
Yeah.
But one of the interesting things is that two of the suspects were, three of the suspects were well-known-ish silent film stars. Two were very well-known silent film stars. The other one was sort of a more obscure silent film star. Going out of my way to try and, after reading it, you know, you're like, oh, I wonder what... that one looked like.
Yeah.
That one looked like.
Yeah,
they were great beauties.
Okay.
And then you look them up and go, okay, they're quite pretty women for in every 1920s kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And you go and try and find their stuff, but so many of their films are lost.
Mm.
Like, one or two of them, is only three or four of their films have survived because I guess they were making short, 10, 15, 20-minute films or whatever it was back then, five real comedies.
I guess kind of the idea of sort of like legacy of those things.
Having any value beyond being screened.
Yeah, it's like, we don't need to worry about it.
Exactly, or they were lost in fires and stuff like that. Yeah. So, we're joining those greats for famous lost episodes of the podcast.
Only the best lose their stuff.
Exactly, so, if you like that, like in Doctor Who episodes, the ones from very, very early, the BBC threw them away.
Yeah.
And they searched the world trying to find tapes. They found them in, like, Uganda and stuff.
Yeah,
like
it's really bizarre stuff. I was looking into the... oh, God, what's the name of that guy? There was a famous BBC episode that aired and they hacked into the broadcasting of it, and it was Max Headroom. Max Headroom, yeah. It's so weird watching it, but no one seems to have a full episode of that. It's kind of, all right, well, that's part of the American bit, and then we fill it in with the British bit, and then we finish it off with the American bit again. It's very, very odd.
It's just true, we didn't realize these things were valuable, so it's very easy to lose.
So
anyway, it's a very long-winded way of saying there are episodes.
Yes, and they will be back.
They will be back at one point in time.
They'll be part of the Criterion Collection, available with the nearest blockbusters.
Yes. So anyway, we should get on with talking
what we
do talk about. Like, last week we got my opinion on the new Stephen King blockbuster, It.
And I think it's fair to call it a blockbuster.
So, certainly, it's crushed box office around the world, so it's done very well. And I think I forwarded you an article today that said, is this now the scary films?
Yeah.
They save cinema. We'll be talking a little bit more about that later on.
But, yeah.
It seems likely that this kind of thing might actually spark more imitators.
Well, yeah, I mean, to give a sneak peek into the rest of the show, we're basically going to be... few of my thoughts on it. Going to be talking about my experience with BoJack Horseman. We're going to talk about the future of cinema. Trav has got the kind of lost great, I suppose, from what people are saying about The Handmaiden.
Yes.
Yes. Was there anything else we were talking about?
We're going to talk about the new Prophets of Rage album.
Ah, that's right.
I think a little more emphasis on the music side of things this year.
Yeah.
Right, mix it up a little bit.
Variety.
I mean, there's so few records out these days I actually want to buy. I actually went out and bought this record. Because that's something, man. Who buys records?
Yeah.
Listen to them on Apple Music or Spotify.
Yeah.
I don't get music streaming services. Someone's got to make sense of them to me one day. But it's like, I have 8 gigs that are on a computer in a day.
It's not too bad with the streaming. Like, I've got Apple Music. And I really like it, and I've got 20 gigs on my phone of data, and I rarely get over the 10 gig mark unless I'm watching stuff on Netflix, because the compression is fine. You know, I mean, if you're a real connoisseur of like sound quality, you might kind of go, it's not very good. Yeah, but it's fine, and I really enjoy it. It's like, oh, you know what? It's a way for me to suddenly like Queens of the Stone Age album. I just streamed that, listened to it. It was awesome. And then, you know, you've just got your favorites and stuff, but it is kind of getting like the App Store, and there's so much shit on there, and a lot of, hey, I want this song, punch it in, and you play it, and it's like, oh, wait, something's not right about, oh, it's a cover. And they can't get the rights to certain artists or whatever, so they get a competent cover so that they can say, oh, we've got 40,000 songs on here or whatever.
I've uploaded my entire MP3 collection compiled over the last 15 years into the cloud.
Jesus.
So through Google Cloud Music, I can actually access it from any PC. So if I'm at work, for example, I can just access...
And reputation precedes you of being an incredible connoisseur of music. So
I had a lot of CDs back in the day, and less of them now. But sort of, I mean, you know, I guess once they're in the cloud.
Are you much into physical collection of stuff like games, music,
that sort
of
stuff? I mean, I guess it's interesting. If you came to our home, you'd probably find an impressive and growing collection of pop figures.
Yeah, the pop vinyls.
Pop vinyls, they do not belong to me. I guess is the short answer. I am of the school of thought that if something doesn't serve a purpose, that I don't really want it.
Yeah.
So, anything you'll find, I guess, a lot of around my home, but I own books. So, I argue a book has a purpose.
Yeah.
It's not going away. I might read it eventually. It's probably not, actually.
Yeah. I think there's definitely more of a tactile nature to books as well. There are people who definitely say, I prefer reading a book rather than flicking my finger from right to left.
I don't have a problem with e-books either. Yeah. I listen to a lot of audiobooks. Probably means I don't buy it. Now, of course, I don't really have the opportunity to drive to work every day to read. So, I don't, figurines, records, CDs, I just don't really see a lot of use to them anymore. I mean, I guess you could say it has a purpose and a use in the sense you can play it, but I have to dig around and find out. I guess my computer could play a CD.
Yeah. And your Xbox.
But I can't remember the last time I went hunting around trying to find a CD. I want to hear that song. I just usually probably do that at YouTube.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty much everything's on there.
Yeah, it's just right there. Boom.
And you look and you go, okay, cool, move on. Some people collect action figures and some people have an amazing record collection. I have a very, very reasonable liquor collection. You can see
it. Yeah, it's a good quality.
So that has a purpose.
Yes.
I can forget it. So otherwise, knickknacks, they just sit around and get them dust.
Yeah, I mean, I used to have a DVD collection of close to 2000 at one point, and I loved it. I loved to be able to see all the spines and stuff, and then Netflix happened and streaming. It's like, I could stream it all and not have to get up and change disc.
That's kind of cool.
I used to watch them a lot. That was when I was at acting school and stuff, like the direct commentary. It was useful. Yeah, and most of that stuff you can kind of go to the Warner Brothers archives online and sort of like get almost like a riff tracks kind of thing that you can just play audio style as you watch the movie. So it's kind of, that's fine.
But maybe that's something Netflix should look into in the future. I mean,
the director's commentary.
And stuff like that, considering they're making
I would love like a director or creator commentary on Stranger Things, something like that.
Absolutely.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah.
Well, what leads into it was like last week we talked about, I talked a lot about Stranger Things, and you read a lot of commentary about it, and a lot of talk about Stranger Things preparing the ground for it.
Yeah.
What did you make of it?
I really enjoyed Stephen King's It. Bill Sarsgaard is a wonderfully creepy and he kind of really plays a little bit more into my fear of clowns than Tim Curry's did. Tim Curry was kind of generic clown, which in its own right is creepy, but Bill Sarsgaard with his kind of bigger teeth and stuff and just like, oh, hey there! It was just the way that he used his voice was just kind of creepier to me, and that sort of don't quite know what time period of a clown he's from. It makes it a little bit of an immortal character, which they say basically it is. He's been around for, you know, eons or whatever. All the kids were really cool. I really liked them. I thought they were all likable and did a very good job on their roles. You're right about Finn Wolfhard. He's really showing a lot of development and growth. I'm really looking forward to seeing what they do with his character in Stranger Things 2. I really liked the girl in it as well. What was her name?
Sophia Lillis.
Yes, Sophia Lillis. She was really good, and how they played her relationship with her father, creepy and brilliant. Really, really liked that.
And she's got a potentially got a really big future. Mm. She's only 15.
Yeah.
She's done some great work so far. And, yeah. You know, you see a performance like that, like,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, it seems weird to kind of say it, but she could be the next Jennifer Lawrence, where she becomes a household name. She's going to be very pretty as she grows up. She's got talent, and as long as she picks the right project, she's potentially going to go far.
Or potentially Shailene Woodley might also be similar sort of young actress.
That's true. She apparently found out that the final one of those was just going to be a direct-to-DVD thing on her flight. She hadn't even been told, and she just read it on BuzzFeed or something. Like, have you tried watching any of those movies? Yeah, it was monotonous. I thought, okay, Kate Winslet, she's a good actress. She is a good actress, but this isn't a good film.
No, I mean, she's just taking money. It's a bit like...
Yeah.
A lot of those films have sort of come in after Hunger Games.
Ender's Game.
Yeah, they all seem to sort of be trying to fill that Harry Potter young adult void.
Yeah.
Harry Potter slash Twilight.
Yes, three, and then the fourth one is on DVD, I think. It's really doing well at the box office, and I really, really enjoyed it. I agree with you. I think it is a little bit long, but I don't really know where they would have trimmed too much of that excess time.
I feel like there was one too many scares. So, don't get me wrong, it's films about, in the sense that you're scaring your audience.
Yeah.
I didn't think they needed to cut any of the character development. I thought that was good. I mean, that's what you want from this kind of film. You want to care about your cast, the kids, you want to care about the African American.
Which is kind of sad, especially considering his role in getting everyone back to Derry in chapter two.
Maybe whoever they cast in that role. But there are a number of encounters with Pennywise prior to the final battle. And by the last one, which I think might have been in the garage, the slideshow.
Yeah, I think
that was pretty cool. There was
the garage, and then they go to the house, and then there's a few encounters in the house, and then they go down into the well.
So while the encounters were cool and scary, and that's what the film was about. I kind of got to the last one, and I was like, quite obviously, sorry, spoilers, we haven't talked too much, but I read the book, so I know what's going to happen. That's all the tips. It's going to be a final confrontation in the sewers where they're going to think they have killed it. But of course, not dead because it's a sequel.
It's the child of it.
And I'm pretty sure I recall none of them dying before that happening. So there was no danger in inviting it. Pennywise was super scary and creepy. So there were three or four of those, maybe five, I don't remember how many encounters they encountered something creepy, and the last one, I'm like, come on, guys. Get there. I know it's coming. Maybe it's just me because I know what's coming.
Yeah.
But I'm like, get there, yes, we know it's scary and it's creepy shit.
But you know, let's just get to the confrontation already. Yeah. But overall, really enjoyed it. I'm curious what they're going to do with Henry Bowers after how they left him in this movie, not giving it spoilers or anything, and just how prominent of a role he plays in Chapter 2. It's kind of... Okay. Yeah, with the help of Pennywise. And it's like, the way they leave him in this one is like, is he coming back? If so, he's pretty hardcore.
Well, we're not surprising it, I don't think it's a sequel, because I feel like half the story is less interesting than the first half, and like the book, he has this amazing story idea, and stuff happens when he doesn't stick around, but like the end goes
aliens. It's like, we're gonna have the last scene with someone catatonic.
Yeah.
That's gotta be entertaining.
I'm not gonna say what actually happens, or recall what happened in case some people haven't read the book or seen the original TV show.
Which was a horrible TV show, which had nothing to do with the book.
I enjoyed every minute of it until we got to the end, and he sort of sits in the way by the ears about who had put this, who was behind putting Durham on town, and then aliens, it's his deus ex machina, it was a really creepy story, but in the end it was just like, okay, so very few kingdoms have a super satisfying conclusion.
Yeah.
And that leaves the filmmakers a bit in a bit of a bind, so they go for Frank Darabont route, as in the Miz, where King actually came up with an alternative, and in which King actually talks to him, that is so damn bleak, it's so bleak but that's so good, it's awesome, and King actually came out and said, you know what, that's actually better than what I was before, and he completely supported doing it, or they just stay faithful to the source material.
I guess there's kind of there is a cachet to Frank Darabont's name, considering how revered Shawshank Redemption is, and how people love The Walking Dead. And
that was pre-Walking Dead, I think.
Was it?
The Mist.
Yeah.
The film, not the TV show.
Really? 10 years? Far out. No.
The Mist 2007.
Holy crap. I thought that was like 5 years ago.
That was One of the fun things about watching is seeing how many times members will get it. Yeah, it's true, it's a precursor. But this is directed by Andy Muschietti, who I've never heard of before.
I don't think he's done any features. I think he's done lots of music videos and stuff.
So he's not a foreigner.
He is definitely from Earth.
There we go. There's a couple of things here.
Yeah.
Okay. He's got 13 credits, and most of those are coming up, apparently. He directed Mama in 2013.
Oh, is that the Spanish one?
I think I recall it.
I think I saw the trailer for that.
Anyway, so that was his first feature, I think.
But he does well.
I mean, it was extremely competent. If anything, long, didn't really hurt it too much. I'm putting my hand, as I said all along, that I knew the story so well. Maybe I was just a bit patient, knowing what was coming and how cool that was going to be, because everything had been so cool up to that point in time. Let's see what he does with Pennywise Battle. So you didn't know that was coming.
Yeah. And I think they did that pretty damn well as well, especially considering they're dealing with younger actors, and there's definitely kind of a point of, all right, if you push it too far, it kind of falls into battle royale territory. It's like, oh, that's gross for gross, whereas these guys are confronting their fear and fighting it and winning.
It involved all of the losers having sex with Beverly to expel Pennywise, and I just don't think you can do that in a mainstream movie. But even in a mainstream, last scene was competently handled and really nicely done.
I got the feeling that this director, if he sticks around for It 2 and it does well and it earns money, you'll probably see him attached to either a DC or Marvel movie or a Fox movie.
Well, that's what happens. So would you say, I would recommend it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Speaking of people attached to DC Marvel, what do you think of the decision by Disney this week to hand over the reins for the final film to J.J. Abrams?
Boring.
I thought it was originally going to be Rian Johnson, who's one of your favorite directors, looking after the next two.
Yeah, I thought, because that was the early talk when he first got in as number eight director. And then they got Colin Trevorrow. I was like, okay, he's a competent director. I don't really think he's got his own style. But he, you know, he did a big box office hit with Jurassic World. And it's like, he's left. It's like, okay, that's fine. They can get someone else semi-interesting. And they got JJ. It's like, okay. So this is basically recounting the original trilogy, because it was George Lucas and then Irvin Kershner for the second one. And I think he actually taught George Lucas. And then the third director, who I can't remember. If I remember rightly, though, he was quite under the thumb of George Lucas. That's right.
Didn't
he do one of the Superman movies? Like Quest for Peace or something? Okay.
But you wouldn't want to put the Quest for Peace on your resume, would you?
No, he did not. Okay. But, yeah, I mean, A New Hope and The Force Awakens have been so commonly similed, and for good reason. What The Last Jedi is going to be, it's thematically probably going to be very similar to Empire Strikes Back. Well, I think just darker and more out there. I mean, comparing New Hope and Empire, they are night and day. And I think you're going to get a similar difference. Not necessarily the same telling of the story like we had with Force Awakens. Yeah.
It's sort of the Nirvana formula for a rock song, so now we have, you know, you've got to go light, dark, you want the first, this is the downfall of your heroes, and then it's going to crescendo up, and damaged, and seemingly scattered to the winds, before coming back together again to confront whatever
they actually come up against in the second one.
I said it after we talked about it last year, I've watched Force Awakens again, and it gets better.
It stands the test of time well.
It's a quality film, but I think most of us forgave the fact that it was a retelling of your hope because you fucked up previous history. Come on, you need to get it back on track.
Once you're back on track, you can start doing something and you kept everybody happy.
Yep.
Start doing something a little bit more interesting, a little bit more inventive than what we were hoping for in this film. So I think a little bit more original. And it sounds like what they want to bring home, what Abe does well, is he aged other directors. He's aping Steven Spielberg.
He did that perfectly.
And if you took it out, I'd never heard of it. You go, that's a Spielberg film.
Yep.
Because it looks exactly like one.
Yep.
In the Star Trek movies, he really, I don't know if he was a director per se, but he was certainly aping a theme, especially the darkness. He just went and said, well, what was last time?
Everyone wants to come, let's remake that.
Let's make a trip.
Switch the spot and go around.
Yeah.
So, again, that's what he does well, and then you hope he was aping Lucas again. Lucas is absolute best as a storyteller, so I don't know that Abrams has, I don't know, the guy's super successful director, but I don't think he has a great deal of originality.
No, and he's now confirmed to me that he can actually direct a film, because his first film was Mission Impossible 3, and that was basically, when you watch it, there's very obvious three key beats of episode 1, episode 2, episode 3. And then his other movies, he's just got stronger. I want to see him basically do his version of Sucker Punch, where he's like, all right, I've been given money, I'm going to do whatever I want.
And essentially, he should be able to do that now. He's a successful director.
Yeah.
Surely you've got something in your passion project.
Yeah.
Something has been in your, I mean, Doctor Horrible, or Midsummer Night's Dream, I mean, I guess it's not original in the sense of Shakespeare, but it's done in a fairly original way.
He didn't direct that, though. He wrote that.
Drew Goddard, yes.
He did the first season of Daredevil as well.
So, you know, I'm with you. I'd like to see him stretch.
Yeah,
I don't think this is a bad thing necessarily. It's a bit of a yawn fest. Originally we were talking, this is going to be a fantastic opportunity to the young talented directors showing themselves, the ability, a chance to really do something important.
That's my biggest concern with him coming back. It's Disney doing with Star Wars what they do with Marvel. Because basically, aside from Iron Man 3 and Shane Black, there is not a single movie in all of the MCU where you can see the director's traits all over it. And they're all very generic, very well done, but they're safe. And I don't want Star Wars to be safe. I want it to be fun, poppy, pulpy, and have some character.
I guess all I can say is maybe what's going through his mind is they had trouble on Rogue One.
With the director and Gareth Edwards, and they had to go back and reshoot, which were expensive.
And they're having the same thing with Han Solo. They had the same problem with Ant-Man with Ed Wright.
So, having problems, I mean, I like Gareth Edwards, I'm not sure calling a director for an English voice film. But having trouble with these kind of directors who are potentially maybe not so reliable.
Who have very firm ideas about what should be done, what should be done, had some bad experiences in recent times. Particularly in their Star Wars properties.
Yeah.
Which has probably cost a lot of money.
Caravan of Courage.
I can only imagine what the reshoots must have cost.
Look, I mean, no matter the amount of money, I feel flawed, and I can tell.
You can see the tear marks.
You can see the scenes where they slot these things in trouble.
I wonder how he can salvage Han Solo from having.
He's another very competent. He's an Oscar winner, but he's not exactly an engaging movie. Like, you don't think, oh, you know what? Beautiful Mind is so wonderfully directed. They're like, no, it's got great performances. It's all held together perfectly fine. You can't see any of the glue. That's all. And he's done all three of them, I think.
So, you know, said.
But he's someone that you get in and you fix any problems. They're like, okay, we need you to hit this deadline. We need this level of quality. He'll get it for you.
And it's a perfectly chromulent choice.
Yes.
You're not going to go, wow, he's amazing, you won't go, oh yeah, that was a Ron Howard film.
Yeah. It's like, oh my God.
So, I mean, you know,
did you see that Happy Days reference?
Fairness. Probably very few directors going around today that do that. It's probably not a very popular, only a very successful director, Scorsese or Tarantino, Chris Nolan, the guys who've actually established themselves and have, and they're now, I'm seeing a very obvious difference between director and an auteur.
I'm hearing that phrase being used more to direct explain about people. And I'm like, okay.
Well, those guys can write their own checks.
Yeah.
I've got the run board. Yeah. So, I mean, JJ should be in that category now.
Use all the lens flares you want.
Yes.
Tell us a story.
Please, no more. He used too many in darkness.
We'll wait and see what happens. Maybe there's something in there that made them nervous.
Maybe they went, this is good, but how well is it going to play?
You know, Ryan Johnson's a guy who's been known to push boundaries a little bit. Yeah.
And we've got less than 100 days to go before it's released.
Well, you'll be sure to tune in.
Yes, absolutely.
Do we want to talk about The Handmaid's Tale?
I haven't watched it, so I would love to hear about it.
I don't know why you haven't. The season's finished.
Well, now I shall watch it online for free. Yeah, I've.
I'm not talking about that, by the way. He's on SBS on demand.
Yeah,
it
is legal.
Legal streaming service with really annoying ads.
In this podcast, we don't break rules.
Handmaid's Tale, someone posted on Facebook, it stars Elizabeth Moss, who's the most easily recognized, of course, Peggy on Mad Men, and other stuff.
Well, that's all the information I need.
Oh yeah, probably best known for Shakespeare's Love, and Max Minghella, best known for being the son of the director, whose name is right now. All the movies I don't like.
Anyway, Max is fantastic in this. So what is The Handmaid's Tale? The Handmaid's Tale is about how you should have a market with novel.
I had never heard of, but set in a dystopian future, a woman is forced to live as a concubine under a fundamentalist bureaucratic dictatorship.
So it's a comedy.
It is. It's a slapstick.
Do they use the Benny Hill music?
Produced by Rob Schneider.
But seriously, this is probably the best show of the year, in my opinion.
I don't think there's anything that's come close to it. Maybe even new season of Fear of Walking Dead.
Okay.
Essentially, to describe the world that it's a little bit too men.
Again, right. If you think of a world where women, the majority of women are unable to see and have children.
Okay.
And in that world, for the society as we know it, for various reasons that are never really fully explained, has largely fallen apart.
Okay.
And the United States has fallen apart, become a very smaller. It still exists, but it's basically a tiny shadow of what it used to be.
Okay.
And it's hinted at some sort of civil war has taken place. And I remember the name of the actual country that's supposed to be in, but it's set in North Carolina, which is no longer part of the United States, part of the new country.
Okay.
And as it sort of says, This new country is run by a theocratic Christian dictatorship.
Okay.
Where it basically poses a severe biblical society. And women who are able to conceive basically kept as sort of concubines, they become they're kidnapped, they are trained to essentially be wounds on legs.
Wow.
So they're assigned to the families of powerful government officials whose wives are unable to have children, where they ritualistically rape once a month, as they call the ceremony.
Okay.
In the hope of executing children.
Wow.
That happens, I think, in the first episode, guys, spoiling it, forgot to say, spoilers up front, up at a note it beforehand, you know, if you haven't by now, you should get on to it, it's really good. I'm probably going to call back on the ceremony, because the first time it happens in the show, you're like,
fuck!
Yeah, it's really fucked up, in a really messed up, good kind of storytelling way.
On the shame meter, could she handle it?
Yes. There's no very minimal gore or horror, there's some violence in certain scenes. The show, we view essentially the world largely through Moss's eyes.
Who plays the character of Offred.
When they become handmaids, their name is taken off them, they're no longer Michelle or their name, or their character's name.
I think in the book, actually, her real name is never revealed.
But you become Fred. Her boss's name is Fred.
Oh, wow.
Offred.
So you basically take the name of your owner, Josephine, in this case. And we sort of screen her struggling to extend her reality, flashing back to events that led up to her being captured and put into a handmaid, and what's happened to her family leading up to that. We learn more about her motivation through those flashbacks, and again more about the events that led up to this world becoming real.
Okay.
What I think really helps the story, potentially why it was perfect at the time, is in a post-Trump world.
In a post-Charlesburg world, where you might have seen in the news recently, Nazis marching in the streets.
Oh, yes, fuckwits, and running people over in the streets in the United States.
So the more kind of open violence and agitation.
You can kind of look at, I mean, one of the things I think I've seen in the show before, kind of science fiction and stories I really enjoy. A lot of ones like this, where you go, that's not the world I live in, but I can see that. You say, watch Black Mirror, and you go, okay, that's not what happens day to day, but I can so easily see us going down that path.
Yeah.
You know, like the episode of Dallas Bryce Howard, and raking people's
interactions and stuff like that. There was an article about how the new Apple 10 basically lampoons part of that show, and it's like, don't know how I feel about that.
I know you don't want Charlie Brooker, but he nails it time and time again. And you go, oh, that's a little close enough to the bone. I mean, if it's Star Wars, I love Star Wars, obviously. I can see how we might go in that direction. And that's a warning to us.
Yeah.
And so if Handmaid's Tale came on TV during the Obama administration, where...
Better or worse, we may hate him. The guy wasn't encouraging Nazis to walk in the street.
There were bad people on every side.
Exactly. I don't think it's a useful disguise.
It's a political tool.
And I don't think Obama did it, but I think you've got to be.
I mean, if you look at surveys, people would be more likely to vote for a Muslim for president than they would an atheist in that country.
So you can't be an atheist. I don't know if he is, but I don't think he gives two shits about religion.
So, I mean, while I don't say going, well, I think he could turn the United States into a right-wing theocracy, I think he could create conditions where something like that could happen.
Yeah.
Where another civil war could potentially take place because you see in that country from afar anyway. You can see the splits forming between the red and blue states. The old fault line of the Civil War is still sore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you saw that fairly recently with all the removal of the Confederate statues and stuff.
So I mean, that's what I think is great about this, is the timing is perfect, in an unfortunate way, where you go a Christian theocracy collapsing and a Christian theocracy forming in its wake.
Yeah, that could actually happen, I think.
And would it be as horrible as this? Maybe.
Maybe it would.
So it's really, really well made. Again, I don't know exactly which of the team networks made it. I can't understand why none of the major networks here want to show it. Maybe having someone rape once a month is critical to sell the advertisers. But again, they put the right amount of money into it, it looks fantastic, it's comically directed. It's a sympathetic lead. The people she lives with are flawed and complex, and can't look at this and just go, Oh, well, the woman she lives with is a cunt. Sorry.
We're Australian, we're allowed to do that.
But sometimes you can see that softening, you learn a little bit more about where they come from, how they got to be who they are. It's not simply painting everyone with a black and white brush, it's a very wide range of grey throughout the show. I think that probably reflects reality quite well. So, episode 11.
Is that like hour long or 45?
45.
Okay.
I can't recommend it. I'll be planning to listen to the audiobook version of Red Wake Clear Danes.
Oh, cool. Unfortunately, I've never heard of it. It was written in the 80s. 25 years ago.
And she saw something coming in the author, I think.
Well, I mean, think about the political... Do you know she's an American author?
I don't know. I have a feeling she's an author.
Okay. Just the general kind of world political viewpoint.
Canada comes out of this, to give some context, the story opens with Elizabeth Moss and her husband, her crime is being in a marriage, actually trying to escape across the border to Canada.
Okay. So Canada actually comes out of this, absolutely, a wonderful place to live, even in a horrible dystopian future.
Canada is still a place you want to be.
The North always rises.
The Great White North. So I was waiting on bated breath.
Okay.
For each episode that comes out because I was enjoying it so much. I hope you get a chance to watch it, and you'll like it as much as I would go, maybe on the Shay scale.
Okay, if you can make it through the first episode, she can make it through all of it, but I think it's an important one to watch, it kind of shows her a warning.
Just looking at the screen caps on IMDb,
it makes me want to watch season two of Man in the High Castle because I haven't got round to that yet.
Me either.
Yeah. So this has got an 8.7 IMDb.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
It's extremely highly rated, well received.
Look, you probably heard all about it now, but go out and check it out. It's probably still on SBS.
Yes. Going on to other greatly rated TV shows, I have kept up my part of the bargain. I've watched all of season 1 and 2, and I've begun season 3 of BoJack Horseman. Still not thinking it's amazing, but I just saw the episode in season 3 where he has to go to the underwater film festival and how it's just him silent and just fucking brilliant. So goddamn good. The fact that I've kept on watching, it's good. I will definitely give it that. I'm not laughing out loud or anything like that. Yeah. I would almost say that it's kind of the closest that you're going to get to Curb Your Enthusiasm as an animated show.
Yeah.
And now that I kind of appreciate that, I'm appreciating the show more.
It's a perfect something like Family Guy. I did this week just watch the first episode of season 22 of South Park.
Okay.
They took the complete Nazi stuff like that.
I'm so surprised.
It's genius.
How do those guys keep doing it? The Simpsons is fucking awful now. Sorry to go on about an animated show, but I didn't mention season 22, or I think it's 22, new season of South Park, episode 1. Fucking nails it, as usual. Absolutely nails it. But again, I don't know that South Park's been a laugh myself silly show for quite some time either.
It's sort of like it's had high points. You're ready. That's very clever. I see what you're doing. That's funny. Although I think that when it comes out, I think at the end of October, we might have to do a review of the South Park Fractured Butthole.
The new game. There will be no way I'm playing that game because the Stick of Truth was one of my favourite games. It's so funny. And apparently,
it's been correctly rated in Australia, so we'll actually get the full game rather than just a crying koala saying, sorry, Australia.
It was still really funny.
Yeah.
Those guys, like, and I think, again, the creators have been very closely involved with Bethesda.
No, it's Ubisoft making those games.
So, look, and look, I think we said it last year, I'm happy for it to be delayed as long as you get it.
Yeah, right. Because the first one was... It looked just like one of the show.
Yeah.
And the comedy was fucking amazing.
And it didn't pull any punches.
No. And it was a really good game to play as well.
It was
15, 20 hours.
If I had a criticism, it was the lack of replay value.
True.
I mean,
but that was just because I loved it so much. Yeah.
I wanted to keep going.
Yep.
I wanted to go back and do it again, but I had so much fun. Once you do it twice, the less fun.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, it's the same with everything. Like, if you tried watching Deadpool again, it is not as anywhere near as funny the second time around.
But anyway, BoJack. I have Fringe ready to go.
Good. I have all five seasons if you need them.
I have all five seasons.
Excellent.
Ready to go. I just need some time to actually sit down and watch. Ladies and gentlemen,
here come the excuses as to why he doesn't want Fringe.
I watched the first episode of Fringe when it was on telly. And then it got strange.
Yeah, it goes, some of it goes really weird.
And it was like, I'm not buying this.
People started off by thinking, okay, it's the new generation's X-Files, which there's elements of it. And then it kind of goes into Twilight Zone. And like, okay, this is cool. And then it just does its own thing. And it's like, ah, all right, this is what it's really like. It's
It kind of reminds me of a show I was watching for a little while, trying very hard to get into, called The Strain.
Oh, yeah, that's the one based off Guillermo del Toro and Chuck Hogan's book.
It's a good book, but of course it stars Corey Stoll, known probably for Ant-Man and West Wing.
Yes.
Not West Wing, sorry, House of Cards. I tried it, and I'm like, oh, I just got a little bit too silly. Anyway, I will get onto Fringe, and maybe it'll be better the second time around. One thing I've been smashing this week is Dexter.
Oh, yeah, you started that last week, yeah.
And this is a show I never liked. Because I was just jumping in at the wrong point. And now watching it again from the start, I'm quite appreciating it. So
okay.
It's good stuff. Even though it's over 12 years old, the noise in the background is a very excited Staffy.
Yes. He's giving his 2 cents into Dexter. It's like, oh, my God, Dexter.
Very excited about the fresh black hole as well.
Well, that's one way that you could describe his farts as well.
Well, this is true. He's a Staffy.
Keeping with the TV thing a little bit, next week we have the start of the Philip K. Dick TV series on Stan. That is must watch. I cannot wait to see what happens with that. It looks so good. I really hope they don't fuck it up.
Yeah, he's a doover. I mean,
yeah.
Quality Philip K. Dick adaptations on one hand.
On the plus side, Nicolas Cage is not involved.
True. I would go Total Recall on a cheese level. For a fairly not particularly faithful to the novel.
Well, it kind of completely reduces the point of him actually removing his memories because no one can read his mind.
Blade Runner, again, it was made a fair departure from the novel.
But it was still a good film.
It was still a good film. And that's about it.
No, Scanner Darkly. That's the most accurate to the book.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Adaptation is pretty good. It was a weird book to do.
And Man in the High Castle.
Man in the High Castle was also quite good.
But so look, maybe they're treating it with a little bit more.
I think it's got Steve Buscemi and Heisenberg.
Brian
Cranston. Yes, thank you.
Yes, you're right. He executive produced it, I believe, or watching it.
Yeah, I think so.
Last night.
Yeah.
So look, I mean, it's a little bit like Stephen King novels that so many have been done so badly.
Yeah, we've only got up to go.
still recovering from Screams. Did you read the book? Did you read the story? It's really fucking good.
It's really good.
And you're like, guys, The source material is so good.
Well, maybe the industry is just bringing it down to the ultimate low level, so I can buy the rights for The World Jones Made and then make the movie and everyone's going to fucking love it.
Well, yes. I mean, though, his name probably has some cachet still.
It still does, yeah.
Well, if the new Blade Runner film does well, it will.
It will.
I mean, it looks amazing.
Ryan Gosling and an older Harrison Ford
and
Jared Leto.
I mean, just those three guys in it.
Yeah.
People are going to turn up. They're going to walk away going, huh? Because there were not enough explosions.
Yeah.
But, and it's
directed by Denny Villeneuve.
If anyone didn't walk away from Arrival going, you're a lot smarter.
I'm pretty certain that I really liked that movie.
What the fuck was it about? Yeah. I had a vibe that kind of reminded me of Contact.
Apparently, it's a similar thing with Aronofsky's new movie, Mother.
Well, that's Darren Aronofsky, anyway. Yeah. It's like, he splits audiences.
Yeah.
There's never been an Aronofsky film yet where people walk out and go, I feel uplifted and full of joy.
Yeah, that is
my
not
life
him.
Is better for having seen that film. Especially like Requiem for a Dream.
And Pie, yeah.
Still be so after seeing that thing. I couldn't make it through The Fountain. I know you liked it.
I really liked The Fountain.
The Wrestler was good, and I've never seen Noah.
I haven't bothered.
I know friends of mine in the States didn't go and see it because it wasn't biblically accurate, which I found terribly amusing. So you think a guy really did get in a giant boat with every animal on earth for a year or whatever it was.
See, my big question, I want to watch this movie and see if it answers the immortal question of how did Noah get all the Australian animals?
I walked.
Oh, of course, yeah.
That's the story, I walked. No one found fossils on the way. It should be ignored.
Yep.
There is actually a replica of Noah's Ark in Kentucky. It's run by a guy named Ken Ham, who's unfortunately an Australian. apparently it's like $40 to get in, though. I went past it one time on I went past the billboard for it one time when I was a couple of states away, and I was like, ooh, that sounds like a lot of fun, but everything at the time.
I just find it really funny. Just going sort of like absolutely accurate, so like two of every animal, like they got woodworms and on a wooden boat. So like 40 days, they're like, for fuck's sake, stop eating.
What are they
insects? Yeah.
What happened with species of insects or whatever? You know,
how did you do that? Plastic baggies.
Yeah, I mean, you get them away from the animals that eat insects.
It's the Disney version. There were actually 360 of each animal, and the rest were sacrifices.
Yes. All right. Maybe that's why I didn't like the film. I don't know. I just thought it was dumb. Someone told me, "Oh, my preacher told me not to go and see it because it was biblically inaccurate." I'm like, can't you make up your own mind about whether it's biblically inaccurate? I don't know. Let's talk music.
Tell me.
The Prophets of Rage is debut album came out this week.
Okay.
As I said earlier, I actually bought it. Steal it.
What sort of music is it?
That's a good question. Wikipedia says Prophets of Rage is an American rap rock supergroup. I think that's probably the easiest way to describe it. I would not, some might say nu metal.
Right.
Of course, those of us who are old enough to remember the nu metal scene, Korn, Biscuit, Linkin Park, to a lesser extent, so they combined rap slash hip hop with metal. And I think that's kind of become a bit of a diss term.
Yeah.
Nu metal, I think it's unfair to call Korn that because they're around a long time before that word came to be.
Yeah.
But basically, Prophets of Rage is the band, Rage Against the Machine, so Brad Wilk, Tim Kommerfeld, Tom Morello, along with two members of Public Enemy, DJ Lord and Chuck D, who's the better term, lead singer of Public Enemy, and Be Real, who of course is the lead, again, lead singer, lead rapper of Cypress Hill.
That's right.
So, it's a bit like the record's very good. I listened to it twice today.
Right.
And it's a bit like if you took all three bands and chucked them in the blender.
Okay.
It might come out sounding a little bit like this. It's a little bit like if any of us are old enough to remember Audioslave.
Oh, yeah.
Audioslave was made up again of Brad Wilk, Tim Kommerfeld, Tom Morello, and Chris Cornell.
Soundgarden,
again, it sounded at the time quite a bit like if you played a Soundgarden record over the top. Machine record, that's what it's going to sound like. It's actually quite good, so it sort of mixes it up probably enough that it, you know, just walk away going, that's all it is, you know,
okay.
Rage Against Machine songs with, you know, really two guys who chuck in and be real rapping at the top. But they do covers.
Okay.
I know they played a few gigs at the beginning of the election last year to try and.
We're going to do it with the power of our music.
Well, you know, some people who say they have a platform.
That's true.
It's their responsibility to sell what they think. And it's not a band who are ever going to be sympathetic to the American Republican Party. They mixed the songs up nicely, so it's occasionally some of the songs actually had more of a groove and sound more like something you might hear on a Public Enemy or Cypress Hill album.
Okay.
But maybe you have a more rocky edge than your strict, you know, hip-hop song. With others on the actual, like, Hails and Cheese is one that stands out in my mind.
Right.
It sounds like a disused Rage Against the Machine riff, and you just had the two rappers, Be Real and Chuck D., sort of singing, rapping over the top of that song. The probably the standout track on the record is Unfuck a World.
growing more and more poignant.
This is a band who obviously,
subtlety?
It's not Train, you know. You're not sitting in the middle of the road singing about love. You know, Rage Against the Machine themselves are an extraordinarily political band. Chuck D, again, has been very political always in his music.
Yeah.
Be Real, I think less so. I've always thought of him as more of an advocate for legalization of marijuana, but, you know, his music has less been, if you listen to Cypress Hill records, they're less political.
Yeah.
But obviously, he has a political bent to his.
Of course.
This is a group of guys who have always felt like they need to change the world. This is what this record is trying to do, I think.
Yeah.
It's trying to make a dent in Donald Trump. I don't know that we will achieve that. It's certainly a giant middle finger to people like Trump and people who support him.
Okay.
If you disagree with, I mean, one of the interesting things about Trump's age is Marilyn Manson, for example, has released part of his video where he kills somebody with a Donald Trump beat him up or something like that. And the blowout from on Facebook when I saw the comments after of people who were like,
"Oh, fuck you, I'm going to sing a dance scene."
I'm like, whoa. Manson fans.
support Trump.
Yeah.
That doesn't compete.
And I see the same thing with these guys, because obviously you find...
I suggest probably most people who follow Prophets of Rage are probably Rage Against the Machine fans, in my experience.
Yeah.
And you see them post live, like they'd be having a concert somewhere, and they post a live video of themselves on Facebook. And then people are like, oh, what would you vote for fucking Hillary? And you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Rage Against the Machine fans who like Trump.
Yeah.
That doesn't compute. I didn't fucking get it. I don't know how you get this to a band like Rage Against the Machine for 20 years, 25 years or so now since that first came out.
Shit.
93 for 24 years?
Quarter
of a century of listening to this band. If you didn't pick up there is left fucking wing as they come. You know, and if you think this guy's going to have anything positive or neutral to say about Donald Trump, we just have an amazing guy. I mean, it'd be like listening to a Kid Rock album and being surprised that the guy doesn't like Obama. I mean,
isn't he running for governor?
He's running for Senate.
So
anything can happen in this world.
The guy who created one of the theme songs for The Undertaker, the American Badass, is running for Senate. This is a weird world.
You know, he's as much as anybody running in America.
That's true.
Even though he can't even think he's qualified. Look, I always, like, if you're a Raging Machine fan, you're a bit like, you know, maybe you think, well, I mean, they haven't released any record in 16 years, 17 years.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's going to change anytime soon, but the fact that they have played together again,
yeah,
10 years ago, this is a fair substitute for your itch that Rage Against the Machine needs to fulfill. I find it refreshing that there's a band out there saying something. One of the great benefits of Trump and the Bush administration, I think,
it brought out a lot of
great art comes from conflict and chaos and tragedy. Great art comes from that kind of time of pain and division, I think, sometimes. So you had bands like Green Day release American Idiot, which is a giant little thing of Trump.
Yeah.
It's probably the best thing they've ever done.
Yeah. Trump?
Sorry, Bush. Bush. So if we get the same, and I suspect you will, because the guy's horrible.
Yeah.
You get the sense of the push of artistry to actually to push back against
it. Always happens. I mean, you look at Bush 1, Bush 2, you look at Maggie Thatcher over in the UK, you look at fucking even references to Putin and stuff that has come out.
Yeah. 10-15 years ago, bands like, I mean, some of the best things that I think one of the most vanilla bands this country ever produced, produced a number of stuff, a number of songs, a number of records, direct disses, if you will, fuck yous to people like John Howard. I mean, in a sense, like a horrible silver lining, to a guy who potentially started when you could have war, but I mean, Venice, we can never be, we will fear, we will always be, he might, but you know, it's it really pushes the artists to actually make a stand. Garbage are a band who are very anti-Trump, if you, they released a single recently called No Horses, which I think again can be interpreted to be anti-Trump, or at least anti-what he stands for. Again, there are a band people, lots of people, like, and they'll come out on Facebook and go, shut up, Justine. Well, again, guys,
That almost sounds like the opening to one of the Limp Bizkit songs.
You know, like, I mean, I think so, more liberal, then it would be weird if someone like Trump came out and said, you know what, Trump, give me a chance. I kind of want
If we have any listeners out there, and if any of you are right wing and Trent Reznor fans, and Travis just rocked your world, please let us know.
Well,
again, so just imagine this person goes, what?
He's been absolutely fantastic.
Trump leans towards it. Yeah, if you've got recommendations on what we should listen to, hit us up at Evil Trav or at The Fried Brain on Twitter. Well, he's probably hiding in a little hole.
Well, he was
just talking about what God thinks. One day we will get recognition. He'll either want to be on the show or block us forever. Have you heard the soundtrack for Kirk Cameron Saves Christmas? Well, you know, the newest. Yeah, just put it age.
Here we go.
Yeah, it'd be 5 minutes. Yeah. Should we talk about the future of cinema?
Let's.
All right.
We did this a little earlier. I was doing a little research earlier today. And it's difficult to nail down where cinema's at right now.
Other than to say
that studio profits this year were down 20% over 2015 levels. And that's a pretty huge drop in the couple of years.
Yeah.
There are some studios who make it out like thieves. Your Disney's in the world who have invested very smartly in
everything.
Your Marvels. Star Wars. Pixar.
Yeah.
And you've got the other end, you've got Sony's of the world, poorly invested in Bad Spider-Man reboots, Ghostbusters.
Wow, that's disappointing. Yeah.
That tells you something, but is this the Netflix effect?
Well, I think that part of it is this year, in particular this year, it really feels like we haven't had any new franchise blockbusters or just standalone blockbuster movies. I mean, everything is Marvel. It's just rehashes of sequels and old movies from the past, like fucking Baywatch. That was supposed to be a bit of a slam dunk comedy. It had The Rock, it had Zac Efron, there's the, oh my god, it's so cheesy, it should be funny.
What do you reckon the highest grossing film of the year has been?
Is that just for America or worldwide?
Well, domestic.
Domestic, okay. Maybe Fate of the Furious?
Number seven.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Number one is Beauty and the Beast.
Really?
Beast took over $504 million.
Wow.
Round
up the top five.
Number two is Wonder Woman, which took $410 million.
Not surprised. That's good.
Number three, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that was there.
Four, Spider-Man Homecoming. $328 million domestically. Five, Despicable Me 3. Jesus. $260 million. I'm going to try and find the global grosses.
So there was Beauty and the Beast, which is a remake of a Disney animated movie. There was Wonder Woman, which is part of the DCEU, whether we like it or not. And you could say that that's an original property because she's never been in the cinema.
But it's part of connected to.
Yeah. It's part of a brand. Yeah. Then it was Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. And then... What was number 4? Okay, Globe.
Because you were talking about Fast and Furious 2nd.
Okay.
When it jumped to place,
yeah.
$1.2 billion. So that's a good result for a terrible film. Even if it's still number 1.
Really?
Still only 1.662, so it's a much closer race there.
Okay.
Number 3 is Despicable Me 3.
Jesus.
Just over a billion. And number this is what I found interesting about this is number 4, the film I've never heard of. Wolf Warrior 2 took $870.3 million. That is the breakdown. A 2.7 million domestic gross. So in the United States, they took $2.7 million, which is 0.03 of its actual profit, or its gross in the States. The rest of $867 million, the 99.7 of its gross. Outside of what we're calling the overseas market, quick look at the poster tells me it's almost certain.
What's the name of the movie?
Wolf Warrior 2.
Okay.
I'm guessing it's a Chinese film. Looks like Wolf Warrior 2. Looks like Chinese writing.
Poster? It's an action drama war movie. China's deadliest special forces operative settles into the quiet life on the sea when sadistic mercenaries begin targeting nearby civilians. He must leave his newfound peace behind and return to his duties as a soldier and protector. So, translation, Chinese market is going boom.
That's what I think number five, Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 2.
Yeah.
So if this film can take basically the global works of Guardians of the Galaxy 2 in China, this is the future of cinema right now. I think we're looking at, as you said, a bit of a break, as you see, from 10 years ago, we have infinitely more internet options than we did 20 years ago. We went out the other week and we saw a video store.
Holy crap.
I went last week to someone else, and I saw a video store, and I went, I was like, oh, I'll just stop and take a photo.
Yeah.
Like you know, that really wasn't much of an alternative back in the 90s or early 2000s. Now with as much as you like, or you can eat model at Netflix and various services, Amazon's and your Stance Award. I mean, and, you know, I guess you might say that the television, technology has come a lot further. You get a picture for a lot less.
I was just at an electronics store yesterday looking at another television for $3,500
going, how do I actually find the money to buy this thing because I need it. You might look at it and go, actually, why do I need to go to a cinema?
Yeah.
Some of these films aren't in cinemas. If you want to see the new Adam Sandler films, they ain't in cinemas. They're on Netflix.
Yeah.
So he's one of the biggest box office draws over the last 25 years.
Yeah, it's I see cinema as we know it not existing. I see it becoming basically a boutique thing where there's going to be cinemas where it's IMAX, 8K, phenomenal screen and sound, and you go there and there's like 60 seats per screen. So you've got more of that deluxe experience. It is, you know, I feel like cinema is going to end up becoming a hipster thing. Oh, you went and saw something in the cinema? Oh my God, that's so cool. I didn't realize they were there. Yeah.
Film, you know, the whole revival of film, people like Nolan, big proponent.
Tarantino, revive that film format, and now he's used the full screen version, the full screen version that he actually intended. I am a little bit more positive about the future of cinema. Maybe the industry will contract a little, maybe there can't be big studios anymore.
Maybe there's not that much business around for that many. But You still go on Friday night down to the local cinema, which is very reasonable price, and I think that might actually be part of a model.
Shout out to Reading Cinema.
$15 for a premium cinema.
Really nice seats.
$21 for gold class. which I think is the one that I saw. What did we go on the same class? I don't know any reason went because it was a film left.
Shit, well, was it Baby Driver?
It was quite nice.
Yeah.
It's just
name is Alone. Well, that's the thing. I mean, you pay... It was like our experience when we went to Nova Central. Yeah, and it's like, oh, yeah, it's going to have a nice drink in this exclusive bar. I'd like an orange juice. I'll be sold out. Really? Okay, well, I'll just have lemonade in a plastic cup. Where's my money going? I could have just done this by going to Coles downstairs.
I think you're right. It's definitely going to be a much harder place for an experience.
I guess in the past it has been a new way to experience the new blockbuster. I think there's anything quite like it in a room full of strangers that can get shit for example. So story, I was a story in the Guardian about horror film, which will be the same sort of cinema. Maybe it's the horror genre, which will come out of left field and say for themselves. I mean, I think they're approaching a point we've talked about this before, where looking again, looking for a totally new year. So films that aren't attached to any kind of previous existing property.
I would have to. Warrior 2 is obviously Warrior 1. So I'm going to go on that one. Dunkirk 12.
Yep.
The Boss Baby, which is kind of depressing.
Yeah.
Your Name, I don't know what that is. And the Great War 20. So that's four films, two of which are very heavily Chinese market focused.
Great Wall and Wolf Warrior.
Yep.
So four out of the 20 are not attached to a previous property or franchise.
And you can kind of argue something like Dunkirk. Chris Nolan is the franchise.
Yes. It's World War II.
Oh, really?
It is. We've got Triple X, Resident Evil in there. Lego Movie, Annabelle Creation, Kung Fu Yoga. I need to see that.
Kung Fu Yoga.
We need to watch that.
See, now, if we're going to watch something called Kung Fu Yoga, we need to watch Kung Fu Hustle as well. That's awesome. I can't watch that again.
So, Alien, Valerian, a film needs to be attached to a property.
Yeah, I think you could argue that Boss Baby in particular was probably an intent to establish that.
It
made enough money.
And
it was the Boss Baby in China.
What saving Disney's ass is the fact they're doing well.
Yeah, but even then, I still think the kind of the shine has come off the apple a bit. I mean, the trailer for Thor 3 looks fucking cool, but no one's really talking about it. It's going to be, it's here, it's amazing, it's great. I don't know what great is. And then, what's the next thing? There's not going to be any staying power anymore. It's like people are still saying, "Oh, Civil War is fantastic," but they're not really talking about it anymore.
Well, I mean, Venice was around a year ago.
Well, it's been superseded by that's what Disney is doing. It's like the short attention spans every 4 or 5 months. Castle in the Sky, still my favourite movie of all time.
Studio Ghibli.
But I mean, people still talk like in the superhero genre. People still hold up The Dark Knight and The Avengers.
I think those films once in a generation. But I don't know.
I still feel like they're purposefully putting these high impact, flash in the pan things, and just putting 5 or 6 months between the superheroes and then every other
very deliberate strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why they're winning.
I mean, we had this conversation very extravagantly last year on Justice.
You really liked it because you were shooting for the stars. Yeah.
And I disliked it because they missed.
Yeah.
I wonder if maybe you made a list in there. For someone like Zack Snyder shooting for the stars and missing by a very large margin, depending on who you are.
Yeah.
You hurt that film.
Yeah.
Significantly.
No, I'd agree.
So, do we want our director shooting for the stars, or do you want to hire perfectly competent, reliable directors. I don't know if that's considering he has a history. But he was the man at the moment.
But that might be something they need to think about in the sense that they want to do risky things.
The
other thing that's happening, and it's pissing off cinemas, is the fact that the DVD, Blu-ray, streaming release. I mean, Wonder Woman, it's out now. 4 months. 4 months since it first came out in the cinema, and just this week I was reading an article about how it's made over 800 million worldwide. It's still in cinemas, it's now everywhere. So basically that's just kind of killed it. It's not going to make any more money at the cinema.
I wonder if people are still going to want to go and see the Dark Knight. I agree. I wonder in this country.
If you're lucky enough, I feel really bad to go back and pay $21 for a movie at one of the competing chains.
But at a reasonable price, I think people still want to go into the dark with a new film. I wonder if these horror films have coaxed an emotional reaction from us, and that's what I enjoy about those horror films, that you get the chills, and that's an emotional reaction.
Yeah.
Now, a bit fairly based emotional reaction to actually prompt fear.
But still, it's heightened and it makes the experience more when the whole cinema in one go goes.
Yeah, it's a great moment.
And just everyone is quiet. You don't see any screens up or anything like that. People are just, because they're assholes.
I don't know if I've had a moment like that in any of the Marvel DC films, but I wonder if we'll see it pushed back against the franchising of the cinema, the fact that it's going to have a brand. The people who will eventually stop seeing these films, or stop seeing the same numbers. In the '70s, we had that Coppola, Lucas, Spielberg reaction where they started making a bit of a wild, now they're the establishment.
Yeah.
But now it's someone else's turn. We need someone to come around again. I hope that happens where someone who had an idea of Star Wars, which was a radical idea, remember, turned down by three studios, ended up being...
You know, he financed it himself.
So, you know, Apocalypse Now, Godfather, those films were pretty radical in the day, but now they've become a property that you can't have a brand. I think what will have to force it, Hollywood's going to have to be forced. Do not let anyone ever tell you Hollywood knows what people want.
It doesn't.
They really don't. I mean, if you look at something like Star Wars, Back by Three Cinemas. Greatest successful film franchise of all time, depending on who you ask.
Yeah.
Potter Films might actually have one.
Well, the Potter Films, I don't know about that, but I was going to talk about Harry Potter. I mean, it was thrown away by so many publishers for so long, and then suddenly...
She's the Richard and the Queen.
Yeah.
People who own the properties or who provide the entertainment. You might think they know what you want.
Yeah.
They don't. They think they do until they think they do, and they won't know it until it's in your face, and you say, and all of a sudden they're like, oh, better get the money back. I was reading a story today that I saw John Wick 2 last night, and apparently the Australian distributor was planning to release it straight to DVD here. Until everyone who's a fan of the first one, fan of the second one, fan of the third one, fan of the fourth one, fan of the fifth one, fan of the sixth one, fan of the seventh one, fan of the eighth one, fan of the ninth one, fan of the tenth one, fan of the eleventh one, fan of the twelfth one, fan of the thirteenth one, fan of the fourteenth one, fan of the fifteenth one, fan of the sixteenth one, fan of the seventeenth one, fan of the eighteenth one, fan of the nineteenth one, fan of the twentieth one, fan of the twenty-first one, fan of the twenty-second one, fan of the twenty-third one, fan of the twenty-fourth one, fan of the twenty-fifth one, fan of the twenty-sixth one, fan of the twenty-seventh one, fan of the twenty-eighth one, fan of the twenty-ninth one, fan of the thirtieth one, fan of the thirty-first one, fan of the thirty-second one, fan of the thirty-third one, fan of the thirty-fourth one, fan of the thirty-fifth one
out, I'll make them again.
Yep.
Two names, DC run doesn't quite live up to expectations.
Well, you're already starting to see that with DC. It's kind of what I want of director's choice. It's like, okay, we're going to bring Scorsese in to do a Joker movie. We might actually get Darren Aronofsky coming in and doing his Batman movie that was going to happen before Chris Nolan. That would be really cool.
I feel like people do have to get this eventually. I mean, I don't know, people will eventually get sick of seeing the same thing.
But it's still going to be a boutique experience. But I think that, especially with stuff like, where so many movies like Pacific Rim, that didn't make enough money to warrant a sequel. And then it did well in the Chinese market and on DVD. And it's like, okay, well, let's do our big budget things. We'll launch them in the big screens, but we won't do them in every screen. It'll be a big bombastic experience on the IMAX screens. And a week later, it'll be available for streaming. There'll be such a fine line between cinema for the big buck stuff. And then the independent stuff and the auteur stuff is going to be, you want to have a visceral experience whilst in the cinema? You're going to go and see this because it is quantifiably better on the big screen with a group of people in the dark versus you and your partner curled up on the couch.
I think what a studio needs to work on is building a sense of goodwill between them and their audience, the goodwill of speaking, cultivating himself and their audience. They need to build that. They've lost a lot of that. They feel like they've lost the entertainment. One thing, just because you're there at a bit of a boutique experience, I'm talking about finished listening to an audio book this week, exclusively for Called the Butterfly Effect. Nothing to do with actual culture. Damn it, you beat me to it. Written by John Ronson.
Okay.
Who, of course, wrote the book that turned into the Goats. He wrote the book that turned into the Big Head Frank.
Yes.
And he also recently wrote the next Lucy's Oh,
that's right.
This book is about Pornhub and the invention of that free porn available universally, the butterfly effect of that.
So one might look at it and go, simply the fact that no one pays for porn anymore means people make less money, they go out of business. The guy who owns Pornhub went out and bought all those companies. So now he basically owns the industry. Every conceivable free porn popular pornography site he owns as well.
Okay.
But it goes deeper than that. He looks at what it's had. I won't spoil it for people. It's really good. But there's a story of a 20-year-old guy who's done 20 years on the sex offenders registry because he was autistic.
And he repeated some stuff to a girl in his class he'd heard on a film film. People who have been exposed to their family as porn stars who have been told that kind of thing. So the butterfly effect is far and wide. It's an interesting exploration of a topic that people don't like to talk about.
But I wonder if Hollywood's experiencing some on a small scale of the same ripples.
Maybe because while film isn't exactly, I mean, like the Hachi movie, he goes, while he's talking to John, he actually taps on the porn and goes, I filmed that last month.
And the whole film's right there. Wow.
So that's not quite the experience of Hollywood has. Hollywood has far more money and power
in if there were
a website that were popping his films up. Like, if you're popping up on YouTube, they're fairly consistently taken down.
Yeah.
They've managed to get things like Pirate Bay blocked in Australia, so we can't access it at all.
No,
that takes 25 seconds to get around.
Not that we ever do that.
Maybe downloading has something to do with it, but also, you know, the fact that they're available sooner on DVD, sooner on Netflix, and there's more choice.
Yeah. I think that might also be the problem is because there's Netflix and they're bringing out their own content, Amazon, Stan, Hulu, all of them, there's so much content. There's only so much time that people have. So it's kind of, oh, our viewership has gone down on X show. It's like, yeah, because they're watching Y.
That's kind of one of the first books. But yeah.
There's so much content in the book, but one of the things, one of the ripples of the butterfly effect in the book, is the invention of custom porn.
So people actually have a specific film made.
So maybe $10,000
There are stories that people who, a guy who owned a restaurant, paid several thousand dollars to have a video made where someone poured ketchup and mustard over a porn star.
There was a guy from Norway who paid to have a film made where porn people destroyed his stamp collection. So this is a thing. It's growing in that industry.
I'll do that for a fiver, but for porn.
Obviously, this is just the focus on the show, it would be far more common stamp pornography being made. Using this method, you can basically pay them to make whatever your interest area may be.
So, I mean, speaking of boutique experiences, this is the ultimate in boutique experiences.
So maybe we're going to start seeing Kickstarter cinemas. Zach Bracco, you get to kind of devise our content. We will put it up on the screen in our chain of Kickstarter cinemas. You have some kind of ownership over this, so you should go to it.
Potentially, it's a variation on the talking about, you know, boutique experiences, customized experiences, and making it an experience, something at football games now, it's a big deal in the Australian football, they try and make the ground an experience, fucking annoying, so at halftime they'll have cuddle cam, or kiss cam, or something, dance off, or something stupid like that they think people want.
I've always said if I won Tat's lotto, I'm a sponsor half time this year in the football, and it would just be dead silence.
Just be on the board, what do you buy me? Dead silence. So building an experience that people who are providing entertainment feel they need to give it. I don't know that we're going to start seeing Matt Damon offering to make a 15-minute short film for you, for a grand, I think you need a little bit more than that, but maybe you can learn something from the experience. I mean, they have been influential on culture before.
DVD, the introduction of those technologies.
So, can we learn something potentially from what they're doing with their dealing with Technology is a tsunami for them. It's a rough tide for Hollywood.
Yeah. On that note, I think we should finish the show.
We've done pornography in this week.
Wait, what's it?
We've done pornography in this week. It's not a normal topic of conversation.
We can always do more. There's always room for that.
Thank you for listening, everybody.
Thank you so much.
New word this week, remember, is Noia.
Goodwill is a cultivation between himself and his audience.
So feel free to use it tomorrow in a sentence and see how you go on that one.
Good night, ladies and gentlemen.